was about seems hard to believe. It was about a year and a half ago that we moved from our place out in the country near Birdsale Park to the address in East St. Paul that we now call home. We had neighbors at both addresses, of course, but at the old place, those neighbors were far enough away. It was all forested, and we couldn't really see that we had neighbors most of the year. Sometimes in the winter, when the leaves were gone, you could get a glimpse, but you couldn't kind of see other houses. And unless people were outside doing something noisy, you couldn't even really hear that they were there. And so we knew there were people living nearby, and we knew them. But it didn't really feel like we were part of a geographic neighborhood so much. And in East St. Paul, our neighbors are much closer. Our property itself, some of you've seen it, it's sort of an anomaly. It's like this little acreage with an old house on it that's surrounded by, relatively current middle class suburbia. So it's a bit of a kind of a country bumpkin outlier. Apparently it was an old homestead, so I've been told. Anyway, personally, I like that. I like that it's what it is. Sometimes though, it does mean I have neighborhood experiences that remind me that that I don't quite belong. And these are personal experiences, and so I'm not trying to make a wider point of the particulars of this, but for example, perfect weed-free lawns do that to me. I'm not trying to grow weeds on our property, but I'm also not trying to maintain, like a polo field. Other things that feel like they sort of set that off for me are like freshly painted or finished, retard or whatever, driveways, like perfectly black driveways that look like they've never been driven on. Trees that have been groomed into elaborate, intricate shapes. There's nothing wrong with those things. They just feel foreign to me. So there's this kind of values gap sometimes between what I care about and what seems to prevail, in the neighborhood. Well, the other day, I had an experience that really kind of clinched this for me. I had gone to get the mail, which takes me kind of right into the heart of the Perfect Lawns and Gardens Club. And as I was driving down the street, I went past this guy on his front lawn who was pressure washing a large rock that was part of his landscaping. I mean, he wasn't sort of like rinsing it off. He was out there with his gas-powered, high-pressure machine, and he was getting every grain of whatever it was that he was washing off. He was getting every grain of this out of every crevice of this rock. He was really going at it. Now, to be fair, I did not stop and ask him what was up. Maybe there was a perfectly, rational reason for all that intense rock cleaning. Maybe there was some kind of fungus on there that he didn't want to get into a tree or to mess up the perfect lawn, or maybe he just had one too many COVID days at home. I don't know. What I do know, though, is that I thought, as I kind of saw this happen, I thought, I like clean, I like order. I'm okay with self-identifying as an A-type personality. More on this in a moment. But this looks to me like a level of trying to order the world that I don't feel like I'm quite wired up for. And I kind of drove away feeling like, it's a good thing our property's kind of hidden from view so that this guy doesn't have to like drive past it on the way home and come home frustrated with my lack of commitment to keeping our landscape rocks squeaky clean. He doesn't have to come into the house in the morning, or sorry, at the end of the day after driving past, our messy rocks, and say to his wife, those new people that moved in that acreage, the hillbillies, that their rocks are a mess. I'm thinking maybe I need to lodge a complaint with the municipality or something. So he doesn't have to do that because we're kind of tucked away, and that's nice for him and it's nice for us. Maybe I'm just not that committed to ordering my world. Now, having said that, anyone that has helped me put out chairs at the table when we met at Creative knows that I'm perfectly capable of being unreasonably committed to the order of certain things. I know what I want and I can tell you why and be quite particular about it. Now, to stay in that illustration for a moment, it still might feel pretty strange to someone that doesn't share my particular combinations of perspectives and experiences and values. So, if the story that you tell yourself about how to put out chairs for a group of people at the table is different than mine, if the story you tell yourself about keeping your landscaping clean and tidy is different than mine, we're going to feel the gap between those stories sometimes. Sort of the way I felt it when I went past, pressure washer guy. And that gap, that the story I'm working from and the story you're working from are different, that's an important gap to be aware of. It's an important gap to pay attention to. And if we start watching for that gap, we're going to see it everywhere. And if we're open to learning from it, we can start to have encounters that teach us new ways of seeing the world, that can enlarge our perspectives, they can soften our edges, they can help us to live with a kind of openness that invites those other stories, the ones that are different than ours, to speak to the stories that we already know. Last week, I was moving our equipment out of the storage space at Creative Manitoba. Some of you are aware already, but if you're not, Creative has rented out the space where we were storing our stuff, and so we had to get it out of there. And in the middle of that experience, I had one of those conversations that reminded me of how this it kind of encountering different stories and having them enlarge ours, how that can happen sometimes. So I had our own van and utility trailer parked right up on the sidewalk in front of Creative so that I could load the big heavy pieces. And just as I was finishing up, this really interesting character came out of the Pan Am Boxing Club next door. Great big guy. At least he looked great big to me. I mean, maybe next to Ray or, you know, somebody, he wouldn't have looked like a great big guy. But that's how he looked to me. He towered over me physically. He had a thick head of black hair. He had a very impressive black beard. He was dressed all in black. He had a large silver chain outside of his shirt. He was wearing mirrored sunglasses. Generally a pretty imposing looking individual. And when he said hello to me, I don't know if this was a clincher. Our imaginations are funny things. When he said hello to me, he had an accent that sounded, to my ears at least, distinctly Russian. And so that whole combination of things just sort of felt like, well, this is an interesting person. And we were just, as it turns out, we were just getting started. I was just loading up the last pieces at the end of the load, and what I was loading into the trailer were sort of the big chunks of our PA equipment. And he could see that that was what I was loading, and so he was curious to know, was this for a band? Was it from a gig? Like, what was the occasion? And I said, well, it might be a little bit misleading, but it's for a church. And he was all over that. He just sort of launched into this. His first sentence was, well, if you're going to use church and misleading in the same sentence. And then he just like launched into this like history of Christianity. And this very informed summary of that history over time and how corruption and violence and oppression were significant themes in that history. And he really knew his stuff. Like he wasn't giving me dates, but he was giving me big chunks of like period history with names, and like he'd spent some time learning this stuff somewhere in his journey. And he wasn't just some sort of disaffected former Christian with an axe to grind. He had really paid attention to the history of that religion, but not in the interest of trying to make it look good. He just was kind of digging into what could be known. And so after he'd kind of unreeled that for a bit, with me kind of grinning bigger and bigger as he went, I said, listen, it's really too bad we're not meeting here anymore, because I think you would have found yourself feeling quite at home at the table. And then he said what I thought was the most fascinating part of the whole conversation. He said, when people are making a religion, they shouldn't fuss. Oh, I didn't use the word fuss, but this is an, all ages show. When people are making a religion, they shouldn't fuss with the dude who's been making things happen for billions of years. People have no idea who they're messing with. So, and then he just sort of briefly mentioned that he was a certain number of years into his journey of living the sober life, which is what had him at the Pan Am, and he headed off down the street. Oh yeah. So I drove away with like this huge smile on my face. Not because of the story he told about the history of Christianity, which is the religion that I've grown up in and around and with which I still identify the most strongly, because it wasn't a pretty story, but because the whole experience was full of what feels to me like the best kind of exploration of belief. I have no idea what this person's story is, but I heard enough to know that the lens through which he views the world, and the story he tells himself about religion in general and Christianity in particular, the way he thinks about God, that there's some overlap with my story, but there's also gaps. There's also a bunch of ways in which his view is different than mine. That particular conversation didn't feel like the right time to say, for example, I'm not sure it's all that helpful to imagine God as a dude. Never mind, I'm not convinced that imagining God as a personal being is a given. I didn't bring those things up. It didn't really seem like the time. You know what I'm saying? That wasn't what the moment was about. For me, that moment was about being present as I could to his story, to his perspective, and letting some part of that kind of get into me and alter the way that I was looking at the day and at the tasks and at the world around me and at this person. If I met this guy again, and I recognized him, and I probably would, I'd want to pick up the conversation. I'd want to say, could you tell me more? Like, where did the knowledge come from? Where did the perspective come from? What are the experiences that informed all that? What made you just jump in with a total stranger on the street corner like you did? I want to know those things. It would be about letting his story, the story he was telling about the world, inform the story that I tell myself about the world. It would be about letting him take me somewhere that I couldn't possibly go on my own. I couldn't go to those places in any way without his story informing mine. A couple of weeks ago when we gathered at our place, Judy was introducing one of her songs, and she said, when I've experienced the light of God, the love of God, the hope of God, it's always been through other people. And she had sort of set that up by talking about how she had some past religious experiences and communities that strongly emphasized this idea of God as a direct intervener, my language, not hers. But just said that, although she wasn't, you know, going to say that that kind of interventionist idea never happened, it hadn't been her experience. Her experience had been, as she described it, that when the light of God, the love of God, and the hope of God had come to her, it had always been through other people. Now, her story, as she laid that out, was different than the story of some of those communities. But her story is still informed by that other story, even though in this particular case, her story might be informed by a contrasting viewpoint rather than by a validating or confirming viewpoint. And in Judy's case, what she shared with our community showed some of the ways that those different experiences have enlarged the ways that she can imagine and speak about and entertain notions of the divine. Again, my words, not hers. The gap, as I experienced Judy's telling of that story, the gap between those perspectives had produced a kind of grace about the differences, a kind of way of being with those differences that enlarges the space in which Judy, in this story, holds her beliefs. And that enlargement, that changes what those beliefs produce in the world, often for the better. And this is kind of the crux. Another way that contrasting stories can enlarge the space in which we hold our own beliefs is when we hear a story that undermines a self-affirming narrative, but also makes us aware that that self-affirming narrative, as pleasant as it may be, is an incomplete one. I don't remember how we got onto this at supper recently, but we ended up as a family having a conversation about how the dominant narrative about Mennonites, at least in this part of the world, often leaves out some of the unsavory but important facts of the history of that religious and cultural group. Now, this can be tricky terrain in the sense that what I'm about to talk about could be understood as undermining another people group. In this case, I feel okay about telling the story because it's the people group that I'm from. If this was a joke, it would be on me. It isn't a joke. That's not how the story goes. But I should also point out that no people group is homogenous. It's of one kind of person. Their groups are made up of individuals. And although we sometimes enjoy kind of claiming, you know, homogeneity or our identity when it connects us to something we understand to be positive, this probably isn't a story that anyone who claims Mennonite heritage would necessarily be jumping up and down to sign on for. there are enough people in the community of the table that have grown up around Mennonite culture or subculture or religion. Those things can be so intertwined. But there's probably enough people that have grown up around some of those influences to be aware of the Mennonite identity that has to do with those people affirming a clear commitment to pacifism and peacemaking. I certainly grew up aware of that, growing up in that culture. And if we're from that group, from the Mennonite culture, it may be that the dominant story that we've told about ourselves is that we're sort of the silent in the land. There's not a lot of talking going on, but there's this commitment to hands-on actions that are about nonviolent peacemaking. Now, that is a lovely story, and there is lots of evidence to support it. I can personally reel off a long list of people that I know and hold in considerable esteem that identify as Mennonite, whose life work has been in that exact realm, who've really poured themselves into that work. And so that's good. That's a very positive lens through which to view a history and a people. Other possible lenses would include the historical fact that the majority of people that identify as Mennonite in this part of the world certainly are of German heritage. And more than a few of those German family trees include Nazis. Well, there's a t-shirt you don't see every day, right? My great-grandfather was a Mennonite Nazi. And if we want to muddy the water even more, we could examine the fact that North American and perhaps uniquely Canadian Mennonites have been very involved in the Middle East conflict as peace builders from a primarily pro-Palestinian vantage point. Now, pro-Palestinian sounds very different and very much better than anti-Jewish. But given the historic connection to Nazism, at least the trajectory of that perspective takes on a different cast, doesn't it? It's interesting. Another story that, in my experience, the Mennonite culture likes to tell about itself is that of its martyrs, people who have died because of their commitment to their beliefs. The part that often goes untold is that a number of those martyrs were people that were also slave owners whose death was at the hands of those they had enslaved. That's a little complicated too, right? Now, for me, and this is important, for me, the point of an exercise like this is not to discredit the positive story or the good work that's being done. It's to enlarge it. It's to point out that the pleasant stories we tell ourselves about ourselves are often in need of expansion. Sometimes that experience of expanding our stories is a painful one, and we want to push it away. Sometimes we have the power or the position to do so. We have the wherewithal to discredit or muffle the stories we don't want to hear, or just to plain not tell them. We have the influence to defame those that are telling the story or to undermine the credibility of the source or so on. And sometimes all that complexity, all those kinds of things that I'm talking about, get stirred into the messy process of digging deeper, of enlarging our context for the story we prefer or the story we already know. They kind of get stirred into the ways in which we can enlarge the space, in which we make a story about the world and from which we make meaning of that story. We could do a similar but culturally broader exercise with the history of the Dominion of Canada, for instance. In fact, in some ways you could say that's exactly what is happening right now as Indigenous voices rise up in this dialogue and the voices of other marginalized people groups and people of color in particular. At this moment in history, we could similarly consider the underpinnings of the racial uprisings in the U.S. It's also, I think, an important way to consider the evolution of our own systems of belief. If I was to put what I've been trying to illustrate here into the language I used when I was telling the story of the rock and the pressure washer guy, I might say that this kind of work, this kind of expanding the space in which we have stories that we make about the world, I might say that this kind of work can disorder our world it can really toss us into a maelstrom. And in a lot of ways, the process in that maelstrom, to the degree that there's a discernible process, includes the same kinds of things that we experience when we encounter grief. It includes things like denial and anger and dismay, rejection of previous stories, maybe even divorce from the story that we were in, so to speak. But if we stick with it, it can also lead us into a kind of reconsideration that over time can become freeing, because we realize that we can look at the story that we already know, the story that we already prefer, with a different lens, one that is less self-aggrandizing or less self-affirming or flattering, maybe even troubling and distressing. We can look at that story with that other lens, and it can, if we will let it, inform the story we already hold in ways that expand that story, that make room for stories that are less familiar, less known, less lovely even to us. Maybe they just feel in every way foreign. Maybe they're geographically foreign, culturally foreign, racially foreign, religiously foreign. They're not familiar to us. They're stories we don't know. And sometimes when they come into the stories we do know, it feels like they take our story and shake it around, even maybe even pull it apart in ways that really don't feel that great and we really have to work through. But when we do, we can realize, we can have this experience of realizing that that's okay. That's okay. We can grow in the middle of that experience. It can enlarge the space in which we hold our beliefs and in which we make meaning of the world. I would say that this kind of experience of expanding our belief system is the underlying thrust of that collection of sayings that I've referenced many times in Matthew, kind of the Jesus' greatest hits, which are all kind of in this formula, this literary formula of Jesus saying, "You have heard it said," and then saying what the people have been told, and their people, so not the foreign sayings, but the familiar sayings. When Jesus says, "You have heard it said," in those sayings in Matthew, he's talking to people who've heard the same thing said that he's heard said. He's talking about the stories that are shared, the stories that they all know, and the stories that affirm the stories that they know, right? So he says, "You have heard it said." Here's a story that you already heard, but I say, and then he tells this other story. He brings out this other lens to look at those same experiences. And it's interesting to me that the writer of the book of Matthew goes far out of his way to make sure that from their perspective, we understand that Jesus isn't trying to undo the lens that people are already using. And the reason I would say that with such kind of confidence in the context of the story is that Matthew talks about, puts the language into the Jesus character's dialogue that talks about the law and the prophets. The law and the prophets, to the people Jesus is talking to, is the story they know. It's the story they're already living in. It's "you have heard it said." It's what they've been told about how the world works and how history works and how the divine or God or Yahweh is in the middle of that story, and who God is for and who God is against, and what that means about suffering, and what that means about eventual relief from suffering, what that means about tyranny, and how tyranny will eventually be just trampled by this God that is for the Hebrew people, and so on and so forth. This is a story they know, and it's been codified by their religious leaders. Can you imagine religious leaders codifying belief? Like, got to make a living somehow. So they've codified this story and put all kinds of ethics and morals and practices and rules around it, and they're all intertwined with the story. What the Jesus character talks about as the law and the prophets, right? This history. And so this is the story they know. And Jesus says, "I'm not here," in the Matthew story, Jesus' character says, "I'm not here to abolish that. I'm not here to say don't have that story. But I say there's a way to expand that story." So that's kind of what's going on in there, right? So when Jesus says he's not here to abolish the law and the prophets, in the context of that story, it's like he's saying, you know, that system you already have, the system you already know, I'm not here to abolish it. I'm here to, and the writer of Matthew uses the word fulfill it, because again, that sort of stays within the general lens, looking at the story through the general lens of someday this is all going to come right, right? So that's why the language of fulfillment is there. If we think about that from the vantage point of the 21st century and the history of the Hebrew people, we'd have to say that whatever Jesus meant when he said, "I'm here to fulfill it," it didn't mean that that whole story was going to come right, because it really hasn't, has it? So maybe it meant something else. Maybe it meant something more like, "I'm going to kick the ball a little further down the field." something more like, I'm here to enlarge that space in which you think about what the world means and what sort of notions about the divine fit into that picture of the world, and what sort of understanding of the complexities of history, including suffering and upheaval and the unanticipated, what sort of room does your story have, does my story have, for something like a pandemic that disrupts a system that was barreling along in ways that we now call normal, sometimes with sort of a wistfulness. On the heels of Jesus saying, I'm not here to blow up the lens that you're already looking at the world through, I'm not here to take away your story, I'm here to move that story forward, then there's this collection of sayings that raises the possibility that there might be a way of seeking spiritual connection with the divine that is not only different, but that is deeper and wider and better, more evolved, we could say, than the way the story that they already know is telling them things are. There might be a way to expand that space that needs to happen. Now, all of those formulaic statements that those sayings start with, that you have heard it said, the hinge word is but. You have heard it said, but I say to you. And that word, but, points to the process. It points to the work. It points to what kind of things we have to do to enlarge the space in which belief is held. It's a way of helping the listeners consider something they thought they knew, something they had been taught their whole lives, but from a different point of view. Every one of those statements points to a gap between what the people listening were believing about the world and about the divine in the world and what Jesus was saying could be the way they viewed and experienced those same things. So it's important to understand, I think, from our vantage point in the 21st century, that, and this is where I think a lot of traditional Christianity stops too soon, that Jesus isn't actually trying to close the story down. He's not actually trying to say, here's the last lens. He's actually trying to say, here's a way to look at the experience you're having of the story you know that enlarges it and that can keep enlarging it. And that's where Jesus goes to the language of spirit being an interior experience that we have. And talking about how the things that, if we want to see good things happen in the world, it's not about keeping a bunch of religious laws, it's actually about being transformed from the inside and having that transformation, that light inside of us grow and come out of us as love and life and care and goodness and all those kind of things. So back to Judy's song, for instance. When I read those texts, I feel like I hear the Jesus character in them saying, listen, I'm not telling you that the lens you view the world through is wrong, but I am telling you that it doesn't see all the possibilities. Go ahead and start with the story you know. Just don't stay there. Enlarge the space in which you're exploring what you believe, and you might find that there are more ways to connect with the divine, to be transformed by the light of the divine, than you've been told that there were. Depending on what we're in the midst of, that can sound like a joyful invitation, a hopeful invitation. It can sound like a daunting one. It can sound like a troubling one. It can sound like a heretical one, like a big, big problem. I would say, and again, this might not be a fair thing to say, a very personal perspective, as so much of this morning's exploration has been. But I would say that if we experience the idea of enlarging the space in which we believe primarily as a threat, that that's really important information about the nature of the story that we're holding. It seems to me that if whatever we're using divine or God language for, if whatever it is that we're trying to describe with that language is ultimately good and is ultimately love, then being afraid to expand the space in which we explore that goodness and love is not something to fear. So, to the degree that it is up to us, I hope that we can enlarge the spaces in which we hold and explore our beliefs. My hope is that we can do that without being afraid of what we will find when we do that, because of either our conviction or our hope or the fact that the story we already hold might remind us that what we're leaning into is love. What we're leaning into is light. What we are leaning into is life, is something that is good, good, and very good. Peace, everyone. I trust that the rest of the long weekend will be good for you as well, that you'll be able to keep your feet on the ground on this slightly breezy Sunday, and that we can all gather again in this space, or if we find a different one, we'll let you know, but probably in this space a week from now. Peace to you all. Bye for now.